For our blind or print-impaired listener and audience, your North Carolina Reading Service now brings you... The Indie Week. The Independent, read this week by John Federson. Our issue dated November the 7th of 2025. And amongst other things, we have election results from several areas around our listening area. And we'll get to those first and then on to more conventional wisdom dispensed by me and IndieWeek.com. Okay, and first IndieWeek brings us to Durham and Wake election results. This is from a blog that was continuing live up until Wednesday night. And I'll give you what we have so far. A good night for Democrats in western Wake County. Final, though unofficial, results. In municipalities across Wake County, local Democrats are likely taking a victory lap. In the western Wake towns of Apex and Cary, the county party's endorsed candidates won all of their seats, and the endorsed mayoral candidates won in Morrisville. So, here we go. We start with the town of Apex Town Council, and there were votes for three. Sue Mew was the top vote-getter in a pack of eight, competing for three open seats on the council. Shane Reese and Ed Gray, who is the only incumbent in the race, placed second and third, respectively. So, I'm not reading much background. I'm just, or even the ballot count. I'm just reading you who won, and in that case, who didn't win. And Mary McKimson, Aditya Alawat, T.J. Evans, Andre Powell, and Kyron Nebolisa did not win that result from the town council. So Cary Town Council, that was Apex. Now Cary, Carissa Johnson won that over Marjorie K. Eastman by a very large amount. And the Town Council District A, the winner was Brittany Richards over Jennifer Robinson. And the Town District, Town Cary Town Council, vote for one. Bella Huang was the winner, doubling the vote total for Renee Miller. Over in Morrisville, T.J. Cawley handily beat his challenger, council member Satish Garimella, 64% to 31. Richard Reinhardt came in third. And there was one at-large seat on the Morrisville Town Council. Harrison Kessling came out ahead of Suba McDeready. And Lisa Dan trailed those two. In Morrisville's Southeastern District 2, Ashit Patel won against Jassi Abhirjan, 56% to 43. And let's see. Then we have final results on the Chapel Hill Town Council. Five candidates were on the ballot for four seats. Two incumbents seeking re-election, Camille Berry and Paris Miller-Fouché, both earned second terms. And they'll be joined by two new faces, Louis Rivers III and Wes McMahon. And Mayor Jess Anderson, who was unopposed tonight, will also get a second term. Next, I'm reading off my iPad from IndieWeek.com and be able to skip around for Wake County. A bad night for incumbent mayors, but a good night for Democrats is the title of this article. Four Wake County municipalities will see new mayors sworn in after unofficial election results are certified. In Fuquay, Verena, Holly Springs, Wake Forest, and Zebulon, four sitting mayors lost their seats, most to challengers from their own town council or boards of commissioners. And although the contests are all officially nonpartisan, Democratic candidates dominated across the board. First, Fuquay, Verena developer and two-term incumbent Blake Messingill lost, a Republican, lost to Bill Harris, a Democrat. Harris won with 57% of the vote. And I don't, again, I won't necessarily go to listing ballot tallies. But then, let's see. Along with Harris, who had retired from the state's Department of Health and Human Services, Brian Haynes and Christopher Voren won two seats on the Board of Commissioners out of a pool of four candidates. They took about 41 and 29% of the vote. Haynes is a first-term incumbent, and Voren is a newcomer to politics. Holly Springs, Mike Kondratik, a Democrat, unseated one-term mayor Sean Mayevsky, a Republican. Kondratik, public affairs professional, small business owner, won 56% of the vote. While Holly Springs has seen an economic boom in the last 4 years under building materials entrepreneur Mayevsky's leadership, with the recruitment of several life sciences companies, including Amgen, Genentech, and Fujifilm, town leaders have faced criticism from the community over its perceived treatment of the town's queer residents. Let's see. In the town council races, candidates endorsed by the Wake Democrats swept a pool of six candidates for three seats, ousting conservative incumbent member Tim Forrest. The races were close, but incumbent member Annie Dries placed first with about 20% of the vote. Newcomer Sarah Larson winning about 19%, and Kara Foster, an optometrist, placed third with about 19% of the vote. Wake Forest, one of the biggest upsets of a sitting mayor last night, in other words Tuesday, came in the northern Wake County town of Wake Forest. Longtime Mayor Vivian Jones was defeated by sitting town commissioner Ben Klapsettle. Klapsettle took a staggering 71% of the vote. It's all the more notable given that Jones, who is unaffiliated, has served in the mayor's seat since she was elected in 2001. Klapsettle was endorsed by the Wake Democrats. Jones may have sealed that deal on her defeat back in September when she introduced, then walked back a proclamation intended to recognize the LGBTQ community for Pride Month. Backlash from local residents was swift. Public records later revealed that Jones retracted the proclamation after leaders of the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, one of Wake Forest's most powerful institutions, and a partner with the town on various development projects, urged her to do so. Wake County Democrats endorsed candidates also won two open seats on the Wake Forest Board of Commissioners, ousting one incumbent, Nick Slavinsky, who placed fourth. Hasib Fatmi, a newcomer to politics who attended Wake County Public Schools and is an attorney, won the most votes, over 5,500 votes. Incumbent Commissioner Keith Shackelford came in second, winning a second term with, again, close, 5,200 votes. And Zebulon. Finally, the small but growing East Wake County town of Zebulon, where incumbent Mayor Glenn York placed second to last out of five candidates, saw the messiest mayoral contest in this municipal election cycle by far. Sitting commissioner and current mayor pro tem, Jessica Daniels Harrison, won that seat last night with about 34% of the vote, but it was a victory few could have predicted. The trouble started for York last year following the resignation of one town manager and the controversial appointment of another on an interim basis and a lawsuit against the town brought by a developer. In the five-way race, York, the embattled incumbent, won 57 votes, or 3% of the vote share. Wake Democrats had endorsed Harrison, the director of Corral Riding Academy, and an incumbent commissioner, Quentin Miles, a Marine Corps veteran. Other results around Wake County. Wendell, a fast-growing town in eastern Wake that's proving popular with young people for its quaint appeal, coupled with affordability, here again, Democratic Party-endorsed candidates won their races, the Dustin Ingalls and incumbent Dean Eatman placing first and second for three open seats, taking about 20 and 19% of the vote. Aesthetics brand manager Kate Benson came in third and eking out a narrow win over American Aquarium rocker B.J. Barham, who won 129 votes fewer than Benson. It'll be interesting to see how this new cohort governs together as Wendell works to balance its explosive growth. It's one of the fastest growing municipalities in the nation with its big small town charm. All right, scrolling on ahead, Garner. In this six-way race for two council seats, Democratic Party endorsees again came out on top. Incumbent Gra Singleton won the most votes, more than 33%. Political newcomer Kevin Stallings, a former legislative aide at the General Assembly, came in second with 32 percentage points. Kathy Beringer, who served on the town council for 20 years, placed fourth behind former Garner Deputy Police Chief Mike McIver. Knightdale, relatively low turnout election for three open seats. I'm gratified to say this. I live in Knightdale, and we went to poll and met all the candidates, basically, in the one major polling place there is, but didn't find this results until this issue of Indy Week. Political newcomer Grady Bussey, B-U-S-S-E-Y, for the community engagement analyst for City of Raleigh, won the most votes, about 25% of the vote share. Letatia Morris won her first election after she had been appointed in 2021. And first-term incumbent and current mayor pro tem Steve Evans was also reelected, winning 21% of the vote share. Over in Rollsville, Rollsville's non-competitive election for three seats on the town board of commissioners, voters still showed up. Their favorite candidate was local boutique owner Jennifer Bernat, won 29% of vote, followed by incumbent financial coach Dan Alston at 26% and mayor pro tem April Sneed at 24%. Write-in candidates won a full 22% of that vote share. I believe that concludes that part of Wake County, and I'll pause for a moment and find us the next article. And the next article, a little closer focus on the Cary Town Council election. I may highlight some of the paragraphs from this article, which is titled Four and a Half Takeaways from the Election. On Tuesday, voters elected three Democrats to the town council over their Republican opponents. Carissa Cohn-Johnson will continue as an at-large council member, and Brittany Richards and Bella Huang will take office in districts A and C. It was a lively, expensive election cycle that clarified what Caryites are looking for in their local leaders. Here are our takeaways. One, Democrats swept the board in these officially nonpartisan races. None of the Republicans even came close to besting their counterparts. Cohn-Johnson defeated Marjorie Eastman by a 30-point margin. Huang also beat Renee Miller by 30 points. And in District A, Richards defeated Jennifer Robinson, the incumbent, by 18 points. It makes sense that the most competitive race of the night was between Richards and Robinson, who held office for 26 years and is the most moderate of the Republicans who ran. It's possible that her association with two more vocally conservative, less experienced candidates dragged her down. Her loss stands out as particularly brutal, considering she coasted to re-election in 22 and 2017. Robinson didn't adopt Eastman's and Miller's MAGA-tinged talking points, but the three candidates campaigned together and appeared side by side on the Wake GOP-endorsed slate. She wrote on an Instagram post, "I had many people telling me they had supported me in the past. They would not vote for me this year for one reason. I am a registered Republican." On a more granular level, the Cary Democrats looked just as dominant as their top-line victories suggest. Huang beat Miller in every precinct, while Cohn-Johnson and Richards both won in all but two of theirs. Taken together, these unambiguous victories point to a successful organizing push by the Wake County Democratic Party, which was very active in Cary this fall. The Democrats' clean sweep fits into a trend that's been unfolding in Cary for a few years now. In fact, once the newly elected council members are sworn in as Democrat, the town council will be composed of all Democrats. That's a major shift from just a few years ago, when the town council had a couple Republicans and a couple unaffiliated members who leaned to the right. The sweep also fits into a broader pattern of Democratic victories across the county. Democratic Party-endorsed candidates defeated conservative or Republican incumbents in Holly Springs, Fuquay, Verina, and Wake Forest this year. Next point, more voters showed up for these elections than usual. It exceeded past election cycles in all three Cary Town Council races. The at-large race saw the most dramatic jump, with about 32,700 people cast ballots, compared to 13,700 in 22. The high turnout could have something to do with the partisan nature of these contests. Every candidate was backed by the Dems or Woke or Wake GOP, which provided resources and get out the vote support. Money mattered, but it was not the best predictor of victory. There wasn't a clear correlation between the fundraising and spending and their final vote share. Huang and Cohn Johnson outspent their opponents by wide margins, but Richards trailed behind Robinson on both fundraising and spending, and she still won her race with 59% of the vote. Richards raised most of her money in small increments from local donors. Robinson has had a long donor list, but a big chunk of her cash came in the form of large donations from people in the real estate development industry. For a decade, next point, for a decade, the Cary Town Council barely changed. That is over now. Before the 22 municipal elections, six of the seven members had been in office for at least 10 years. Now that Wang is replacing Jack Smith and Richards has defeated Robinson, relative newcomers will soon outnumber council veterans 5-2. Come December, the mayor, Harold Weinbrecht, and an at-large council member, Lori Bush, will be the longest-serving active town council members, with about 18 and 14 years under their respective belts. New voices was the theme of this campaign cycle, particularly for Richards, who believes hers is what gave her an edge over Robinson. Four, the next Cary Town Council has a mandate to preserve town services, make strides on housing affordability, and raise taxes if they must. The Republicans tried to varying degrees to make it about the budget being too big and taxes being too high. The Democrats talked about how great Cary's town services are, how beautiful its parks, how innovative its development projects, justifying the cost of living in town rather than arguing about the bottom line. Voters embraced that message, granting the town council their implicit blessing to keep doing what it's doing. One area where the candidates seemed to be out ahead of the current town council was on affordable housing. Huang, Cohn Johnson, and Richards all spoke about the need for more diverse, affordable housing types that are accessible for Cary's service and public sector workers. All three told Indy they want Cary to work with private and nonprofit partners to build more affordable housing, something the current council has only just begun to explore. And that will conclude that article. All right, folks, after the specific election results, I'm going to revert to a report that came out about a week ago in Indy Week about the Wake Forest mayoralty. Vivian Jones, who lost, as I've already indicated. Records say that seminary leaders urged her to drop a Pride Month proclamation. When Wake Forest Mayor Vivian Jones walked back that proclamation in September, she did so at the request of leaders of what is arguably the town's most powerful institution, the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, which owns hundreds of acres of land in the northern Wake County municipality and occasionally partners with the town on development projects. Public records for the town of Wake Forest, initially reported by Wake Forest resident Tom Baker IV in a local Substack called Wake Forest Matters, show that the seminary's president emailing Jones on September 5, that's 3 days after Jones announced her intention during a Board of Commissioners work session to make the proclamation in October, urging against the move. Quote, While I firmly affirm, fully affirm the dignity and worth of every individual, including those in the LGBTQ community who are made in the image of God and deserving of love and respect, I must respectfully express my opposition to a government-sponsored celebration of sexual identity, wrote Daniel Aiken in an email with the subject line, Reaching Out on a Concerned, and addressed to Vivian. Quote, government has the difficult task of serving all constituents, and sometimes that means refraining from actions that elevate one perspective over another, continued Aiken. Not issuing a proclamation doesn't diminish anyone's humanity or rights. It simply acknowledges the diversity of our town. He signed off on the email, Danny. In a Facebook post to the Town of Wake Forest page on the evening of September 9th, a message attributed to Jones stated that she had mixed up Pride Month, which traditionally happens in June, with LGBTQ History Month, which is, quote, observed in October in cities and towns throughout the United States, unquote. Jones added that she had come to the decision that Wake Forest will not recognize Pride or LGBTQ History Month at all. Some of the language in Jones' statement echoes language in Aiken's email. Aiken wrote, A government-endorsed Pride Month, while intended to support one group, may unintentionally alienate another. It risks sending a message that the town officially supports one set of beliefs, while disregarding another deeply held by many in our community. Jones wrote, I now realize that by expressing support for LGBTQ community, I may have unintentionally suggested the town's official support for one set of deeply held beliefs over another set, just deeply rooted. Therefore, after careful consideration, and as an acknowledgement of the diversity of convictions throughout our community, I have decided not to proceed with issuing any proclamation related to LGBTQ History Month. According to the public records, which were shared with Indy, Ryan Hutchinson, the seminary's executive vice president for operation, forwarded Aiken's message to Wake Forest town manager Kip Paget with a brief note, FYI, just 1 minute after Aiken sent his message to Jones. Town of Wake Forest staff did not respond to multiple requests from Indy to verify or provide copies of the records. On the afternoon of September 9th, Hutchinson emailed Paget again, referencing Aiken's original message. Hutchinson wrote, Our desire is not for the town to act in a discriminatory manner, but to represent all the people of Wake Forest. We hope that the mayor changes her position on this matter. However, the seminary does need to consider its partnerships and whether they can continue to exist in situations when parameters change. This does not mean our values have to align perfectly in those partnerships. However, some issues mean that we cannot partner. That evening, records show, Bill Crabtree, the town's communications and public affairs director, emailed town staff about a draft of Jones' social media post that he was planning to publish on the Facebook page. And he wrote, Please let it marinate, and unless absolutely necessary, hold off on posting anything else on the town page until tomorrow. We are aware that it will provoke a firestorm, but it must be done. He posted that message after 8 p.m., and by the next morning, it had racked up nearly 1,000 comments. According to the records, a call between Jones and Hutchinson also took place on September 9. The call is referenced in an email from Aiken to Jones on the 12th, thanking her for making contact regarding, quote, her decision to remove the proclamation from the agenda, which would have made the town's proclamation official. Aiken wrote, I knew this is not an easy decision, but I appreciate your willingness to listen. He added that he had seen the responses to Jones's Facebook post and lamented, quote, that social media is so often a seedbed for unhelpful interactions that mischaracterize and spread false information. Jones responded to Aiken on the 16th. She said, The proposed Pride Proclamation, quote, became political immediately, unlike others in the past marking Arbor Day or Building Safety Month, for instance. She wrote, This proclamation was different. It created division and discord. It was not what was best for the town. Aiken and Hutchinson did not respond to requests for comment for this story. Jones sent along a brief response to a request for comment on the September emails, saying to the Indy, "As I've stated, I always try to make decisions based on what is best for Wake Forest, and I realized very quickly this was causing deep divisions in our community, and that was not in the best interest of our community. This did not stop the Pride Fest. It was held as scheduled. I attended and enjoyed it." While town and seminary leaders exchanged correspondence over this proposed proclamation, the North Carolina Values Coalition, a socially conservative Christian group that has lobbied for book bans and anti-LGBTQ legislation, including House Bill 2, was email blasting its members about the issue, urging them to, quote, stand with Wake Forest Town Commissioner Faith Cross, who had said she opposed the Pride Month proclamation during the September work session. The group's messages provided pre-written language for members to send to Wake Forest commissioners to oppose the proclamation, asking town leaders not to promote, quote, a second Pride Month, a confusing request as Wake Forest Pride has for the past 2 years been celebrated only in October. The subject lines of the group's initial email referenced the upcoming municipal election in which Jones is being challenged for the mayor's seat by a fellow commissioner, Glenn Capsaddle. Hundreds of people from across North Carolina emailed the commissioners and mayor with the subject lines, "Do not proclaim October Pride Month. Stand with Commissioner Faith Cross and respect community values in Wake Forest," the public records show. The Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary is affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention and has operated in Wake Forest since 1951, when it was part of the original Wake Forest University's campus. The seminary owns about 600 acres of land in Wake Forest, including its central campus, student housing, a golf course, and undeveloped land. The town and seminary have partnered on various projects in the past, including a 200-acre mixed-use technology park and an 18-hole disc golf course. Last year, UNC Health Rex announced it was seeking approval to build a $400 million hospital in Wake Forest on a 50-acre parcel of land that the seminary owns, but in February, state regulators turned down that proposal. In his email to Jones, Seminary President Aiken referenced the long-standing partnership between the town and the seminary and praised Jones' leadership of the town for more than two decades. The two are apparently personal friends. Aiken mentions his, quote, earliest days in Wake Forest when I was a regular at your beloved restaurant, Jovie's, in the 1990s. And Jones wrote, she considers herself, quote, blessed to have known you for so many years. Aiken, who announced this month he will retire in July of next year, wrote in his initial email, "I want to express my sincere appreciation for the way the town of Wake Forest and the seminary have worked together over the years. This partnership has flourished in large part because of the tone you've set as mayor, one of mutual respect, shared heritage, and a commitment to the good of all who call Wake Forest home." Well, next, Indie Week revisits the union campaign for Amazon, which is expanding to Durham. That campaign to unionize Amazon has set its sights on Durham, with Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment launching an organizing drive outside the company's RDU5 warehouse on Monday. Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment translates to CAUSE as an anagram. It's its second union push in the state, the first in Garner, resulting in an election defeat by a 3-1 margin in February that organizers challenged with the National Labor Relations Board, alleging the company coerced its employees into voting no and violated protections for union organizing. That election complaint remains ongoing. Around 50 demonstrators rallied in support of the campaign kickoff at the truck entrance of the RDU5 facility on Monday afternoon, handing out union materials to workers finishing their shifts and raising their fists to delivery trucks honking in approval. Brown said, they thought they had buried us, but all they did was plant us. And the thing about seeds is that seeds, they will always rise. They rise in Garner, they rise in Raleigh and Durham and Winston-Salem and in Charlotte. Organizers said the campaign will target four facilities in the Durham area, including the RDU5 warehouse and three others. The union estimates that RDU5 has around 1,000 employees, while the other three each range in the hundreds. Italo Medelius, cause secretary, said in an interview, the good thing about Durham is that the facilities are smaller. Bringing all of these facilities together will give people a lot more solidarity to share strategies, to talk about what's going on inside these warehouses. So we feel very, very confident that this campaign is going to turn out differently. Durham City Council member Nate Baker called for higher wages for Amazon workers at a rally in November this year and said the city stands with them. A key tenet of this campaign is fairer wages. According to the campaign, workers start at $18.50 an hour, less than half of what MIT estimates constitutes a living wage for a single income family with one child in the Durham area. It starts at $18.50 and caps at $22 an hour, regardless of experience. At the RDU 1 facility in Garner, pay begins at $18.50 and goes up to $23.80. Amazon spokesperson Mark Heintzman said in a statement in February, but he added that, quote, pay is not capped and that the company raises hourly wages every year. Supporters with the Union of Southern Service Workers and other area unions joined Monday's event in solidarity, as did Durham City Council member Nate Baker. The Durham Council passed a resolution in June that enthusiastically encourages Amazon workers in the city to unionize. Baker said, to cheers, the city of Durham stands behind you in this fight. What's your wage? It should be higher. What's your leave? It should be longer. You deserve better. Amazon did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the Durham Union campaign, but in statements earlier this year during the Garner effort, the spokesperson, Eileen Hards, said the company supports all employees' right to decide whether to participate in a union. Quote, our employees have the choice of whether or not to join. We believe both decisions should be equally protected, which is why we talk openly, candidly, and respectfully about these topics, actively sharing facts with employees so they can use that information to make an informed decision. She added that Amazon believes employees will find joining a union unnecessary and, quote, favor opportunities to have their unique voice heard by working directly with our team. The fact is, Amazon already offers what many unions are requesting, safe, inclusive workplaces, competitive pay, industry-leading benefits, including health care on day one, prepaid college tuition, and a 401k with company match. Opportunities for career growth and more, said Hands. At a rally in Durham on November 3rd, a cause information booth features signs in both English and Nepali. To date, the only successful union campaign at an Amazon warehouse took place in a New York shipping facility in 2022, led by the Amazon Labor Union. No other unions have won recognition by the NLRB to negotiate on behalf of warehouse employees. Jorge Meza, a worker at RDU5 who volunteered with the union effort, said he's pleased that the campaign has come to Durham, saying, I think it's a really smart move. Durham has a rich history of labor organizing, organizing within intersectional communities here. Medelius, the union secretary, said part of the learning process from the first campaign was getting an in-depth understanding of the Durham facilities beforehand. This has resulted in a multilingual campaign with pro-union signs in Spanish, Nepali, and Arabic present at the rally, reflecting the diversity of the warehouse workers. Medelius said, we feel strong enough inside all those facilities that if Amazon wants to retaliate, we're ready to jump in the boxing ring with them. We're here to announce we're not going anywhere and we're going to unionize. This represents causes. Second, Union pushing the state, the first in Garner, resulting in an election defeat by 3-1 margin in February that the organizers challenged with the National Labor Relations Board, alleging the company coerced its employees into voting no and violated protections for union organizing, and that election complaint remains ongoing. Around 50 demonstrators rallied in support of the kickoff at the truck entrance on Monday, handing out union materials to workers. "I come to tell you we didn't lose. We learned," said CAUSE President Ryan Brown. "They thought they had buried us, but all they did was plant us." I'm skipping ahead because it looks like starting to reread paragraphs here. I believe that is it for that article. Pretty sloppily edited by me. All right, in terms of length, this next article is a long one. I have held it from October 23rd and because of the press of other stories, but this I call a think piece, an in-depth thing, and it's about Gear Cemetery over in Durham. From far away, the clearing is small and silent. But among the sprinkle of trees, a small group of volunteers stands in pairs around shallow dips in the ground. Each dip is marked by a small flag. A volunteer is standing in one, holding a tool that looks almost like a pogo stick with a spike at its end instead of a spring. The volunteers have been shown how to hold it, how to push this tool, called a probe, into the sunken earth about every 6 inches, across the middle, and up around the edges where it rises. It's not so hard. Here the soil is soft and the air is cool. The probe hits something hard. A dull thump sounds and the earth turns, hums back. But after some digging, it turns out this something is just a large tree root. He steps another 6 inches forward. The probe hits something else, something that creaks like an old seesaw. Clarissa Trotta, volunteer and board member of Friends of Gear Cemetery, says, "We really don't want to be digging a lot to get stuff out of the ground. It's just not appropriate to do. The mission really is to try to identify those who may be buried in these spaces so we can bring back respect and honor to the site." Holding a small shovel, Trotta digs around the probe and reveals the source of the squeaking, an old metal grave marker. The probe pierced right through it. Friends of Gear Cemetery, a grassroots organization of volunteers, uses grave markers like these to identify grave sites at Gear Cemetery, a historically African-American cemetery in Durham, North Carolina. Since its inception in 2003, the organization has led cleanup efforts to maintain the once-neglected cemetery and has been working with firms to perform archaeological services, such as identifying and resetting headstones. And despite there being no surviving records from the cemetery itself, volunteers have researched the genealogy and history of those buried, reconstructing stories of their lives. Deborah Taylor Gonzalez-Garcia, president of Friends of Gear Cemetery, says, "Before we were recovering, and now we're kind of restoring, and we start to look at how were cemeteries maintained." Trotta often tells new volunteers about the history of the metal grave markers. Once, they would hold a paper with the information of the deceased, protected by a thin wall of glass. But like the one the probe pierced, the paper on nearly all the markers is lost. Now only the metal remains. As it continues restoring the cemetery, Friends of Gear Cemetery has a new questions ahead of it. How do you preserve the cemetery for generations to come? And how do you honor all the people buried when some of their stories are still unknown? Until 2019, private donations funded the bulk of Friends of Gear Cemetery's work. But then, the organization received its 501c3 status and started applying for grants. More than a year later, the North Carolina State Historic Preservation Office announced the recipients of Emergency Supplemental Historic Preservation Hurricane Disaster Relief Fund. Friends of Geer Cemetery applied in partnership with the nonprofit Preservation Durham, another organization dedicated to preserving Durham history, under a subgrant for survey projects and resiliency planning to better prepare cultural resources against future disasters. And in January of 2021, they got it. The grant, nearly $48,000, was used to pay for various archaeological services. Cultural resource management firm Richard Grubb and Associates Incorporated performed much of this archaeological work over the next few years, from ground-penetrating radar to a light-ranging and detection survey. The work investigated the number of depressions in the cemetery, which are the dips and slopes in the ground. Sometimes they're just a part of the earth's terrain, but they can also represent burial places, where wooden caskets disintegrated into the earth over time. Between roughly 600 and 1,400 possible grave depressions line the cemetery, according to the Light Range and Detection Survey. Some are just 2 or 3 feet deep. These surveys revealed more than just the number of depressions. They revealed where they are and why that matters. Trotta explains, from the air, what you couldn't see from the ground is there were definite rows in the cemetery, that the cemetery was purposefully planned. And sometimes there's a mythology that, or, you know, racist attitudes of, you know, African-American folks just bury the people in the ground. They don't have any of that right. But that's not accurate in this space. As the restoration process continued this year, friends of Geer Cemetery leadership realized that future projects could not start before it knew what exactly was in those depressions. Deirdre Barnes, one of 11 members of the cemetery board, the Friends of Geer Cemetery board, said, "Even the things we wanted to do, we had to be really careful, but if we want to put a sign there, we have to make sure we don't put a sign where someone is buried. You know, we don't want to dig down into somebody's grave." Barnes is also a co-chair with the Friends of Geer Cemetery Descendant Council. These two groups, which have 4 overlapping members, lead the decision-making of the cemetery work. This year, Trotta began training volunteers to probe. The probe only goes down a few inches to find signs of a burial site, like metal grave markers, slate pieces, bricks, or stones. Not every family had enough money for headstones, and many would use other items to show where their loved ones were buried. In fact, while Friends of Geer Cemetery estimates there are about 1,600 burials in the cemetery, only around 200 have monuments that are still visible. Durham's African-American families did not have access to a public city cemetery until the opening of Beechwood Cemetery in 1924, more than 50 years after the city itself was founded, according to Preservation Durham. Until Beechwood was established, there was only one city cemetery, Maplewood, and it was restricted for white students. Geer was privately owned. Jesse Geer, a white farmer, sold the land in 1877 to the 3 African men, John O'Daniel, Nelson Mitchell, and Willis Moore, who then created Geer Cemetery. Copies of this deed can be found in the Durham County Main Library. While the City Health Department officially closed Geer for overcrowding in 1939, according to Preservation Durham, Friends of Geer Cemetery has found that the last documented burial occurred in 1945, and a history of neglect would soon follow. When Barnes was a child, her grandfather drove past Geer Cemetery. "You know," he told her, "you got family in there." But when she looked, all she saw was woods, and she wondered, how could she have family living in the woods? The Durham City Council had occasionally funded cleanups of the cemetery before, often working through other organizations. But By 2003, it had been 12 years since the city's assistance and since any coordinated cleanup of the cemetery. The overgrowth returned. Vines of poison ivy, thick as an arm, climbed up and dangled from trees. Underbrush flourished, suffocating the ground. Several people, including Durham historian Robert Kelly Bryant, who had organized cleanup of the cemetery before, became increasingly concerned. Jessica Thompson Eustace, former secretary of Friends of Gere Cemetery, says, "Mr. Bryant and I thought we could call a meeting in the library and then people would come out of the woodwork that were interested. And they did. That was our first meeting, and Kelly Bryant dubbed it Friends of Gere." Eustace became secretary for that newly formed volunteer organization led by Bryant, which returned to the city council with the same request. Again, it was answered. More than $15,000 was approved for Triangle Residential Options for Substance Abusers Incorporated, that's TROSA, to do a one-time major cleanup, plus quarterly cleanings for 1 year. The city continued to do occasional cleanings of the cemetery, as did other long-standing partners like Keep Durham Beautiful. In recent years, Friends of Gere Cemetery began cleanup efforts with a new vigor. Back in 2018, the organization was rarely meeting, if at all. Then a homeowner living in the house behind the cemetery grew wary of a tree near the cemetery's edge and had it cut down, says Gonzalez Garcia. Trotter says it was intentionally brought down and landed across the grounds. People were like, "What is happening?" It was like waking up from a deep sleep. Friends of Gere Cemetery started regularly meeting again, with Gonzalez Garcia as the organization's new president. And the following year, the Descendant Council was formed and the organization received that 501(c)(3) status. And they began regular Saturday cleanups to clear trash and ivy from the back half of the cemetery, in part to prepare for this future archaeological work they now had the vision and funding to realize. Volunteers cleaned up beer bottles, car parts, soda cans, rugs, carpets, or whatever else was thrown there over the decades. The city of Durham frequently picked up this trash and participated in the cleanups too, especially by spraying the poison ivy. So work days look different these Saturdays. Starting this year, volunteers have alternated between cleanup days and probe days. One cleanup workday, the usual volunteers are joined by a small group of students from North Carolina Central University, and instead of trash, they're recovering tree branches. Sweat sticks close to backs on this humid September morning. The volunteers load tree branches into tarps or wheelbarrows as they talk, wheeling those branches across patches of periwinkle to the cemetery's right edge is easy, but a heel slipping into uneven ground is even easier. It takes some practice to find the rows where the ground is flat and drive that wheelbarrow steadily over it. One probe workday, volunteers probing at a depression found three stones just a couple inches below the surface. Two halves of a headstone were stacked neatly on top of a footstone. These stones, back together, mark the grave of Annie Bumpus, who lived between 1889 and 1911. It was also the first new headstone Friends of Gere found by probing underground. Most of the discovery and genealogy of the known graves in Gere had already been done earlier by Friends of the Cemetery, but Bumpus was new to them. The organization had never seen her stone before, nor any mention of her in their records. Trotta says, "It was good incentive to keep going. We hope to really be able to do that for more individuals." The Bumpus headstone was one of many that were reset this year. Under the scorching heat of early June, Jason Harp, director of cemetery conservation at Grubb & Associates and another conservator, stood more than 30 headstones back on their bases, funneling lime-based mortar through the cracks to hold them together. The largest they reset was a tall obelisk of swirled marble, memorializing three members of the Banks family on one side. They were landowners in, they were landowners in Durham's High Tide District, a thriving African-American community that started in the late 19th century, according to Preservation Durham. Barnes says, I tell my friends and people that I meet, if you were born in Durham and your mother was born, your parents were born in Durham, and your grandparents were born in Durham, you have relatives. You have ancestors in Geer Cemetery. Now, Friends of Geer hopes to backfill those depressions using dirt provided by the city of Durham. It's part of cemetery maintenance and an important part of restoration, says Gonzalez Garcia. Leveling the ground would also make the process of families visiting loved ones safer and easier. Barnes got involved with Friends in the early 2000s after reading a news article about them. When she saw where the volunteers worked, she became interested in her grandmother's maiden name was Geer. Is there a connection, Grandma? She had asked. Yeah, said Fanny Mae Geer Barnes. My father was buried there. Okay, well, I think I'm going to join this group and see what it's all about. Okay. Barnes' great-grandfather was born into slavery to Frederick C. Geer and a woman named Priscilla, who was enslaved on his father's plantation, she says. Preservation Durham records indicate Frederick Geer was likely to be the son of Jesse B. Geer. And while Barnes' father was quite excited about her research, especially as she learned more of her own family history, her grandmother could remember where the plantation was, where the tree stump at which enslaved African Americans were sold remained. Barnes says they're bad memories, and she didn't want to relive those bad memories and didn't necessarily want to connect with that side of her family. Friends of Geer Cemetery knows of at least 50 descendants like Barnes. Many of those buried at Geer were born into slavery, omitted from records, and ignored by their city. And many descendants of those buried at Geer have moved away, made lives elsewhere. As the year comes to a close, Friends of Geer Cemetery will start hosting tours. Eventually, the ground will become too hard to probe. Now, more than ever, it is important to recognize those buried at the cemetery whose identities are still unknown. Vera Whitsenden, who co-chairs the Descendant Council with Barnes and serves as a secretary for the Friends of Geer Cemetery Board, said, It's been an incredible, fascinating journey these last 5 years to be involved with those people who have become our friends. Her husband's ancestor was Margaret Fawcett, the founder of White Rock Baptist Church, which was one cornerstone of the Hayti district. The Descendant Council has spent some time deliberating how exactly it should honor the lives of people whose stories are unknown. Wisenton says, there were a couple other designations that were mentioned, but we all liked Beloved. So that's our goal. So as Friends of Geer Cemetery continues backfilling, these graves will start to be marked with something more permanent than the flags of the archaeological surveys, something lasting even longer than the metal grave markers. A stone will be placed on these graves with just one word engraved, Beloved, because those were people who loved and were loved. I'll close today's Indie Week articles with Durham's most consistent voters. And this is about Catherine Farrell, never misses a Durham election. I will not have time to read this whole thing. The front room of Catherine Farrell's house on Fayetteville Street is less like a living room and more like a museum. Framed photos hug the wall space and sit atop every bookshelf and table. They contain the smiles of her children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, even a photograph from the 1920s of her high school girls' basketball team from Douglas High School in Warsaw. One is a portrait of President Obama. In another photograph, Farrell is pictured beside Hillary Clinton. There are newspaper clippings and ornaments scattered among these images. There's a section of the wall hidden behind where the front door swings open, dedicated to plaques Farrell has received. One reads, Mother of the Year 2002, awarded by Mount Gilead Baptist Church. The certificate next to it recognizes Farrell for her dedication and service to the Durham chapter of the National Council of Negro Women, Incorporated. The items in the room are a collection of hundreds of memories gathered over her 113 years, and counting, on Earth, which make her the oldest person in North Carolina. They showcase her persistent dedication to community engagement, having voted in most elections at local, state, and national level since she moved to Durham in 1945. Though the records prior to 1985 are hard to come by, the Durham County Board of Elections records show she has voted in every general election for the past 25 years. They are also a testament to her resilience. Catherine Farrell was born in 1912 in Warsaw, a small town about 100 miles southeast of Durham. By 21, Farrell should have been able to vote, but this was the time of Jim Crow laws and tactics of disenfranchisement, like polling fees, literary tests, and intimidation, prevented young black women like Farrell from being able to vote. By the time she was able to vote, Farrell understood the gravity of having a voice. As I talked to Farrell, writes Paige Stevens, she sat upright in a chair with her daughter Shirley adjacent. She wore a rich blue blazer and skirt and was decorated with pearls around her neck. Though she used a walker, she insisted on standing for a photograph. It was a right that other people have that you don't have, her daughter Shirley Farrell said, and then you got it. You need to use that right. And this longish article closes, what makes Farrell extraordinary is her ability to persevere and bring others with her. She has dedicated her life to her community and her family. And in doing so, she's never failed to honor the voice that she was given. She instilled in her children the same motivation. Quote, if I can finish high school, learning by an oil lamp in a fireplace, you have got to finish high school, Shirley remembers her mother would say. That closes Indie Week for John Federson for this week, and it will become a podcast after its initial broadcast on Friday. And we hope you'll tune in next week when we get to our next weekly issue of the Independent Indie Week for the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you, everybody, for listening.